Hey, everybody. On this episode, we're happy to introduce Lisa Helminiak, the founder of Azul 7, a design firm from Minneapolis that we recently welcomed into the OST family. Lisa is interviewed by OST design director Brian Hauk, and they discuss the role of design in technology and its ability to make products that help secure customer renewals and add lasting value. Please join us in welcoming Lisa to OST and enjoy.
Today we're with Lisa, and she has a kind of a deep background in design research and advocating for design within companies. I'm wondering, could you share a little bit about your background and kind of what led you here?
Sure. Thanks, Brian. It's really great to be on this podcast. I'm now into like 6 weeks, maybe 7 weeks as a staff member at OST after running Azul 7, my design, human-centered design company for 13 years. So it's a big transition, but very exciting for us because we have always been a design-first organization working with technologists, but we needed to expand and get, you know, a deeper bench of design working with IoT and you know, some of the things that OST has been, had in their expertise quiver for a long time. So we're super excited to be joining and advocating for design within technology and moving forward with the great designers at OST. So my background really has been working in design for, over 20 years now, and watching the evolution of design, you know, from really a marketing practice or a corporate communications practice really into much more of a strategic practice. So that's what I'm really excited to talk about today and to talk about, you know, how OST is approaching design and strategy.
That's great. You know, it was interesting to use the phrase advocating for design in technology.
Yeah.
And so that it just feels like those are like two different concepts. And what does that mean? How does that manifest itself in business?
Yeah, great question, because, you know, design has always been part of technology. I mean, if you look at the great technology companies, design has been an integral part. So Apple and, you know, Microsoft came to it late, but they got there. even, you know, the startups, Airbnb and all those things, they've had technology at the strategy table from day one. And I think people have realized it's not just about the technology, it's about servicing our customers and delighting our customers. And so design is that desirability lens on the technology. Mm-hmm. You know, I think the modern technology infrastructure really has those three stools. One is, you know, desirability, feasibility, and viability. You know, it has to be desirable, which is where design comes in and design practices. And you've got viability, and that's the business side. And then feasibility, which is, you know, all those great technical minds working on a problem. And things are more complex than ever. We're not building websites anymore. We're building products. We're building ecosystems. And, you know, design has, just as technology has morphed into new tools and new ways of working, so has design. I just don't think every company has kept up with it. They may not have needed to, but today they do. So that's why we're here, and that's what we're working towards.
That's great. You know, as you were talking, I was thinking about the word design. And I've heard a lot of different definitions of what classifies design, what qualifies design. And a lot of times I've been in conversations where design is sort of characterized by kind of visual design. I'm wondering, what are the different flavors of design that might fit inside of a company like Apple designing a product or designing something more complex for these times that we have more complex issues to resolve?
I think that's a great question. design has many layers. If you think about just human endeavor, we are designing things. And, you know, what gets the label of design is a great question. You know, it's really, you know, it is that delight layer, that desirability layer that goes through everything in a company that has now become more specialized skills. So, you know, if you look at it as kind of a nested ecosystem, you could think of it as, you know, kind of visual design, communication design, product design. You know, that's that next level. We have to design the product. Service design, that is an emerging field. We live in a service economy. The fact that we are just now starting to think about designing services is really important and a huge movement forward. In Europe, they call it service design. In the United States, we call it customer experience, but often we're talking about the same things. And then there's the ecosystem design, which could be, you know, business models and, you know, how do we tie product, service, and communications together better? So as we're looking at how companies impact the planet, impact society, those ecosystem design strategies become more and more important. So as you can see, there's different levels of design. There's different schools of design. Obviously, there's architecture too. There's infrastructure. There's, you know, city planning. There's lots of design. But we all have to work better together and get things moving and know our roles so that we can do the best design we can because we've got important problems to fix.
That's interesting. As you're listing out all the various types of designs, that it feels like there's different definitions of what is good design. You know, in some way, I would imagine like some of those disciplines, it's about creating a memorable moment, right? That like sticks in people's minds. Where other times, it feels like a good design might be more about inclusivity or, you know, making sure this can hit the widest range of people possible to scale.
Yeah, that's a really good point too. I think, you know, coming out of the old advertising days, it was all about wowing people, right? Being unique, being, you know, distinctive. I think people want to be unique and distinctive, but, you know, it might be better that your software isn't all that unique and distinctive and works as expected. You know what I mean? So I think the design brief and the design strategy has to be adapted to the specific moment of the customer journey. So at the beginning, the brand piece may need to still wow people and be distinctive, but the product design probably should work as expected or work in a way that really supports the user need as best we can. And, you know, that might be, you know, not a visual design at all as we move into voice technologies. You know, and if you think about inclusive design, how do we make things as simple as possible? And voice is an exciting new way forward with that. So, you know, design needs to be the right design for the right place, time, and user. And that takes a while to figure out. That's why we like using the framework of human-centered design, because it helps starts to unpack some of those differentiations and needs as we are trying to design, you know, a new ecosystem for a product, let's say. So we use that framework. And some people may be familiar with that. It's been around for a long time, probably over 20 years. But companies are just really starting to adopt it as part of their toolkit, just like Agile has come into technical development. Human-centered design and design thinking are tool sets that have become more ubiquitous across organizations.
Yeah, it's interesting comparing it to Agile and some of these other methodologies that people use to bring products to market. You mentioned human-centered design and design thinking. Do you feel like they're the same thing or are they different?
I think human-centered design is that macro view. So it includes design thinking, but there's other tools and techniques that are inclusive in human-centered design. Design thinking is a specific framework that comes out of the Stanford D School. It's got a process framework. It's a great tool set. We use it a lot. But there's other human-centered techniques, such as behavior design and lean startup and things like that that people use. So it's an ecosystem of tools, I would say, that is included in human-centered design.
Yeah. You know, as you're talking, I'm thinking like it seems like one of the roles or one of the needs that design fills in product is integration, right? And kind of having a mindset around what type of design do you put into the situation to help integrate these systems, these changes that are happening. Are there like questions that you might ask to kind of diagnose what is the business context for what type of design should we use?
Well, I always start with the end user or the people we're designing for. It may not be a user, it might be just a person. That's where it all comes from, right? If we're not meeting the right need, it doesn't matter what the business thinks or, what the business model is. So that's where I think designers can really add value with design tools like design research, where we're actually doing qualitative on the ground landscape research that can be correlated with qualitative research coming out of, data sets. And we can start seeing what's really happening with people and make good decisions and better decisions moving forward about what's the right design approach, what are the right technology tools, how do we approach things. I mean, if you think about, examples in healthcare, everyone's trying to rush to like remote patient monitoring and telemedicine in healthcare. And no one's thought about how that technology goes into the house, especially with an older, chronically ill person. And it's just a bad design. Like it's not working well, because how does that person get it set up? How do we ensure that they're using it? Does it feel, like their privacy is being invaded? Those feelings impact the use of technology, and we've got to acknowledge that. Even with the stuff that's, like AI and things, if you don't feel like you're getting the right information back, or if the system doesn't understand you because of an accent or something, that's bad design. And, we rush to technology solutions without thinking through every aspect of that user journey. And that's where all these things come together. Service design impacts the technical design, absolutely, even in B2B cases. In fact, we're seeing, and there's data showing that B2B is just as important in terms of user interface and ease of use and having people feel like it's a comfortable situation to use a product as it is B2C. They will leave products. People will leave products because they're too hard to use. I'm seeing that. I see that every day. So as we have a more mature technical ecosystem and world out there, the expectations for use and ease are higher every day, even in industrial settings. So it costs money. If it takes extra time for people to get their work done, that costs people money. And so there are great business cases for why design can help save money, save time, and de-risk a situation.
It's really interesting to talk about the differences between B2C and B2B, and that, in the B2B world, the buyers are usually separate from the users, right?
Yeah.
And I think a lot of times it feels like features are added to kind of entice buyers.
Yeah.
But the usability of the product lacks, but then it seems like people, the staff votes to not use the product, right? Like
right.
Just because it looks good on a sell sheet and it has features, it doesn't mean people are actually going to use this. And it's a massive investment.
Yeah. And I think that's where, it's going to come back and bite you at the end. You may get the sale, but are you going to get the renewal? And I think that's, that's, you have to get the renewal too. And if your product doesn't change enough, it doesn't adapt. Again, people are willing to give a product a chance if it meets a specific need and it's a new, product in the market. It's like, cool, that looks great. It solves a problem. Then we get it. And then there's fast followers entering the market and they do it just that much better, right? Are you going to stay with the old, system, or are you going to jump systems? And I think we've done, you know, Azul 7, my company has jumped systems many times because we see a product that's better and meets our needs better, even, you know, disentangling all the data that's in there. We've done it more than once. So we're not the only ones. People will do it. And it's honestly, it's why make messy and complicated products? It's just, it's not necessary. And we have tools and techniques to create better and simpler products from the get-go. And if companies can't get on board with that idea, they're going to be behind. They're going to lose market share, guaranteed.
It's interesting. Yeah, exactly. And, you know, I was going back to the example that you gave of telehealth or, you know, people rushing to figure out how to deliver healthcare in the home environment, right? Yeah. And, you know, just even all the behavioral aspects of what is it like talking to a physician sitting in your living room versus in a doctor's office, right?
Right.
And what kind of, what's my comfort level with that and privacy issues and things like that. And so in some ways, you know, the issue isn't technology in that we have the technology and we have the features, anyone can have those, but it's really kind of how you phrase it, untangling, what is the user experience problem of that?
Right. And there's multiple user experience problems, right? Mm. Just getting the technology in the home is a big problem. How do you set it up? How complicated is it? Does it have to plug into a hub? Is it on you know, Wi-Fi or is it on Bluetooth? You know, all, that alone is one layer of issues. Second layer of issues is, does somebody want to use it? Is it, does it make them feel safe and comfortable? Is it easy to use? I'm noticing with my own parents that even though they've had, you know, computer devices for their, you know, older years, my mother's ability to swipe on her iPhone is getting harder and harder for her. And I've read some things about the skin changes that happen when you age and there's less oils in your skin so that the device registers your movements less. I mean, that's a design challenge, right? And so, you know, she's struggling with things that she didn't used to struggle with. And I just think it's physiology as opposed to, you know, knowledge at this point.
Mm-hmm.
So there's layers of complexity.
There are. So I wonder, like, how can design help to de-risk some of these ideas before launching, right? Like, how can we kind of see into the future and plan for the unknown?
Well, I think that's where the framework of design thinking comes in, and it's a great tool set. It really is breaking design into first empathy gathering. So we understand the context of our users and what they need, first of all, bottom line, what is their need? And then how might we fit that need, right? It's helping you come up with the right solutions to match a need. Then part of the framework is developing as low fidelity a prototype as possible to actually test an interaction or test an idea very quickly. So we're doing many multiple iterative testing with, you know, interaction or product ideas so that we can see if the idea or the design is even viable and works for people or even of interest before we start spending lots of time and money putting this stuff into complicated software solutions and putting design on it and getting development going. It's trying to keep things as low fidelity as possible to discover if it's working. And that investment upfront, it may feel slower to people, but it basically takes your requirements, what you call requirements, and validates that they're really not requirements. They're a hypothesis of what requirements might be. And allows you to test those that hypothesis with people to ensure that they're the right requirements. Mm. Then when you have the right requirements, then we spend money on building stuff. So the goal is to reduce cost and get to a better solution quicker.
Interesting. Yeah, you know, it's interesting. There's like this balance between market expertise, subject matter expertise and understanding the usability from the user's perspective.
Yeah.
And it feels like a lot of times requirements come from subject matter experts or, market research, but there's a difference between market research and user research.
Oh God. I've seen so many, you know, lists of requirements. You know, we validated, we did a survey on it, it's all good. And then, you know, someone builds it and it just doesn't come together. Well, there's two problems, really. There's, is it the right requirement? And number one, did we build it well and design it well? So it could be the right requirement, but we didn't manifest it very well. We didn't design it very well. And so people can't use it or they don't understand it, even though they might need it. So there's two layers of problem we're trying to solve also with the design. Not only is it the right thing that we're designing, but did we design it well? And so that's part of the process, is where we're trying to disconnect those two things so that we're really clear on what we're trying, where we are with design and what we're trying to get out of it.
Interesting. So is the feature functional to solve the user's problems? And then is the interface, does it allow people to actually access it?
Right, exactly. And it's, you know, a dual problem. So yeah. I've seen plenty of great features that people like, but then they're hidden or they're hard to use or they're not fitting the design pattern of the overall product. And so they don't get adapted or adopted. And so that's, we have to figure that part out too. So design.
Yeah, and then
design can help with, you know, multiple layers here.
Sure. Absolutely. And it feels like, you know, it's hard to get away when everything is moving online, especially in this COVID world, right? Everything seems to be moving to cloud and more digital. And we're having experiences with tools like Zoom, right? Or, other online experiences. And then those experiences tend to be our benchmark,
right?
That we hold to all of our experiences, right? And so,
yeah, that's where, again, the consumer experience is driving, and it has for a long time, you know, the experience of any product, right? I think the tolerance for bad product design is going down and down, which is good, right?
Yeah, right. Yeah, also probably that it's easier and easier for people to enter new markets with technology, right? It doesn't take a big manufacturing plant, and you just have to have a few developers and, you know, upload it to various online marketplaces, and then you can compete with anyone.
Yeah. I also think it's generational. So we have Gen Z and Gen X and Gen Y, you know, really taking over as the, you know, workers, the biggest bulk of workers in the country. And, you know, they grew up with digital, they're natives, they're not going to put up with bad design. Whereas maybe, you know, Gen X and boomers were a little bit more tolerant of experiments, bad design experiments.
Right. Yeah, that's a good point too. The shifting of the generations, right? You know, as we kind of go through this change in the culture.
Well, even content. So here's the thing. I think text, content, imagery, everything is part of the design of a product or a solution. And even that, the change in the way, generational change in how people are consuming media and what's interesting to them, and, you know, length and size, and, you know, is it video, is it text, is it, you know, pictures, is also impacting how we design. So we've got to be aware of that and attune to it as we go forward too. So those big banks of, you know, long form content, which I still like, I read long articles, may not be the right thing for every user base. So,
you know, as you're talking, I was trying to put myself in the shoes of a business who, you know, maybe they've never really embraced design. And I was wondering, what might be your recommendations for a first step?
Oh, that's a great question, because I think a lot of people are now thinking about design. I would start, you know, again, I'll go back to start with trying to understand your user, the people you're designing for. I think you can hire design researchers. You can, you know, any designer worth their salt now knows that they're working out of a base of research and has some level of facility with that. So I would say send, you know, hire a designer or send your designers out to better understand your customers. They have the tool sets to do it. Qualitative research methods, even a conversation is better than nothing, you know, so talk to them, watch what they do, observe them in their environment, using your tools, videotape it, you know, write down what you're seeing and communicate that to the rest of the organization and explain why there's gaps in desirability. Mm-hmm. If the designer's job is to be the voice of desirability, start with where are your gaps and go from there. And then the design piece of it can come after that. But everyone has to be on the same page and understand where the problem areas or where the gaps are.
Interesting. So go out and have conversations with your users, define some gaps and align on what those gaps are.
Yeah, and even better yet, have conversations, but if you can, observe, because another thing that you'll find when you start doing this work is that people will say one thing, they'll say, hey, I love this software, it's great, and then you'll watch them use it and they're missing half of it, or they're not using it properly, or you actually see it's not really fitting their need very well. I have multiple stories about that, but we wanna see what's happening in real life, because a lot of times people have created their own workarounds on your software. You know, if you walk in, we always have this saying that if you see a lot of post-it notes on someone's computer that are about your software, there's a problem, you know, because what they've done are designed workarounds to help them, or cheat sheets or whatever it is. So look for those things and figure out what could your software do that would help them avoid those things. Make it easy for people.
That's great. This is a really insightful conversation. You know, I like just kind of breaking it down into where should you start, because people may feel the need for design, but it's kind of can be challenging or intimidating to take that first step.
Yeah, I would just emphasize design does not mean any longer just visual design. So I think if you walk away from this podcast with one idea, that would be design is not just visual design. Design is the plan to meet your customer or your user's needs. And so who's going to do that? How are you doing it? And how are you going to staff it? And you've got to find the right people.
That's a great point to end on, right? That's kind of a good focus point and a simple point to remember moving forward.
Yeah.
One last question. We ask people this question. The history of OST is currently OST is out of an old board game manufacturing company. And so we kind of like to bring that spirit into these podcasts, right? Because our culture is important to us, and it's a reflection of the space that we're in. Are there any games? What are your favorite games? What have you been playing lately?
First of all, I love games. I actually did a TEDx talk about how we need to bring more game design into how we work, because it helps people realize they're not failing, they're just leveling up. But
I love that.
I love, okay, so I'm kind of old school. I really am old school. I like Monopoly because it was the game I kind of hacked as a kid and figured out how to win that game. So I knew how to win that game. So I like that. This is going to really date me, but my favorite computer game is still Tetris, because I just love the music in it and it's just mesmerizing. It just kind of makes you just,
All right. Well, thank you for your time today, Lisa. This was great. Yeah.
Thanks, Brian. It was great to have this conversation. I'll do it again anytime.
OST, changing how the world connects together. For more information, go to ostusa.com/podcast.